My name's Professor Steve Hall, speaking from Newcastle. I'm in the Workers' Party of Great Britain, and I run the Economics Forum. And we do work on the party's economics policies and try to inform committees, various committees and leaders about the party's political messaging regarding economics and finance.
Now, Steve, one thing I've always felt about economics ever since school, I've never studied it, but I've always felt it's a bit of a dark art. The idea is that there is a little club that you can join called economists, and they understand what's going on, and they're not really interested in letting the rest of us know what it's all about.
Yes, I think it's often been described as more of an art than a science, but I prefer the term an art dressed as a science because they use an awful lot of equations to explain dynamic relationships between quantities, prices and demand curves and supply curves, excuse me, or this sort of thing. And they tend to get it hopelessly wrong, don't they? Remember 2008, only a handful of economists got this right, including my good friend Professor Steve Keen. And they use these things called dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, believe it or not. Now, that's a mouthful, but what it means is that they think that prices and demand and supply float around this equilibrium, and markets are magic vehicles, they're magic mechanisms for finding that equilibrium point and making sure everybody gets what they want at the right price, and the firms make the right profits, and the government take the right tax, and everything's going to be hunky-dory, and we're going to, on the road to Nirvana, just have faith in the market, and everything will be okay. Well, 1929, 2008, and then there's world wars and the resource wars and regime change. We know that's utter nonsense. The economy is now global, of course, and basically, then you could regard it as a pseudo-religion. It's something that has faith in the market, not total faith. They know that the market can be volatile. They know that it can be a problem at certain times, and particularly if you do, governments do the wrong thing. So they tend to blame governments. They're too taxing too much. They're not taxing enough. They're spending too much. They're interfering with the market, distorting it. And then if governments leave markets alone, they correct themselves. And they seem to think the market has magic powers. But what they leave out all the time is this thing called agency. Human beings who make decisions about things like prices and production and what sort of stuff people should get. And they blame, they say, oh, the Soviet Union fell apart because, bureaucrats in Gosplan, the central office in Moscow, were planning stuff and they couldn't plan. They didn't know. But that's what they do. They're planning stuff all the time. Looking at market signals, obviously, but they're making plans and they're making decisions, and their decisions are the ones that cause the problems.
Well, look,
And
we've got a bunch of economics correspondents for the national press, TV, radio, and newspapers up in London. It frustrates me that some basic questions never seem to get asked by them. And I'm going to ask you one of them now, which is, how do we know if the financial system is serving humanity or enslaving humanity?
Well, that's a profound question at the heart of economics, and that's something they're not prepared to answer. And when they are prepared to answer, they refer it to so-called experts who are all neoliberals and believe in neoclassical economics. And what they will say is the market is actually an era, an era, an arena of free activity. So it frees humanity. They say that it allows humanity to make all of these billions of decisions, and this magic market will tell producers what to produce, and everybody gets what they want at the right price. That's what they believe. And it'll go wrong now and again, and you'd have to correct it a little bit, but it'll correct itself if you leave it alone. People will suffer. Everyone gets unemployed. Businesses will close. You'll have a recession, and you'll have high crime and populism, but all that stuff will all blow over eventually, and the market will get us back on track. I mean, basically, they're mad, and we're in the grip of a mad cult. So anyone who believes that is really It's not a thinking, independent person, but a member of a congregation who believes. And we're not supposed to believe. We're supposed to believe in spiritual, you know, spiritual things. We're not supposed to believe that there are mechanisms on Earth that are performing miracles. But that's what they want us to believe in. So it doesn't exactly enslave us. It is an authority. It disciplines us. It punishes us if we do the wrong thing. You know, you've heard about the bond vigilantes selling off bonds and the foreign currency exchange traders selling off your currency, causing inflation, causing business to close, making your imports more expensive and all of this. So it has a disciplinary authority that stands over you. If you do anything wrong, you're punished. But of course, a punishment has to be decided. So there are people, powerful people operating in the money markets who make these decisions. So really, it doesn't enslave us. It creates what Hamid Minsky called upward instability. And that is, the more successful it is and the more stable it becomes, the more likely everyone else is, everyone, all the investors and the business people, get too excited, speculate, and the whole thing comes crashing down like it did.
Well, look, what about this term wage slavery? I mean, it might be in a bit of an exaggeration, the sort of thing used by anarchists, etc. But some people do feel enslaved in their jobs. They actually want to leave the job. They can't find another job. They've got a mortgage or whatever. They've got a family to support, and they do feel trapped, Steve.
So that's debt slavery. So they only need the wage because they can't get what they want, and they need to get in debt to get it. So if they weren't in debt all of the time, they could still do work. They could do work independently and get paid for it. They could choose how much work they could do. They could maybe reduce the working week, or they could maybe go part-time, or they could work around their family circumstances or the community, or what the community needs. And if they weren't in so much debt, they could tailor. There's always going to be an element of wage slavery because we create surpluses. That's what work is about, creating a surplus. But who gets that surplus is a question, of course. We should get that surplus. So in a sense, we're always enslaved to ourselves because we've got to do work. And work is, you know, is compulsory. I'd rather you just use the word compulsory rather than slavery. So, but it's the debt that enslaves us, because we've got to earn so much money, a certain amount of money, to pay off our debts. And I think someone was telling me the other day, who's expert in, I'm not an expert in housing and land. I think you probably know more about land than I do, actually. But someone was saying that on average, we're paying 44% of our income on rent. So we're enslaved to the landlord, and we're enslaved in
landlord class. And of course, most of the local authorities and the government have basically given up on building this council housing. But look, another thing that the Faisal Islams, the Ben Chews, the Robert Pestons, these correspondents don't really talk about is growth. Well, they say growth is, if you want to use your religious analogy, it's almost like an icon at the front of the church is this thing called growth. Now, it strikes me that growth is a good thing in some circumstances, but there's both good and bad growth. So when you get a doubling in rail fares or electricity prices or rents, that's growth.
Yes. Well, the problem is that they express growth with this thing called GDP, gross domestic product. The problem is, you know, like inflation. I mean, inflation's a will of the wisp as well, because you have different indexes. You know, you have a consumer price index and all other indexes. We measure inflation in different ways. They, at one time, I can't remember the year it was, somewhere in the late 80s, 90s, they actually removed housing from the inflation index, CPI. So now that all that huge asset inflation that, you know, we think was created by irresponsible lending people stuff, you know, loans that right to the limit of their ability to pay. that was, removed from the index. And now we have a different conception of inflation. It's all smoke and mirrors. I mean, these are just fingers, numbers on accountant sheets. So, yes, we have this GDP thing, which is gross domestic product. The problem is we have a huge shadow economy, some of it criminal. Now, a lot of the transactions aren't contributing to GDP. So what growth in what? So it's growth as measured by accountants. And in a financialized economy, you can have huge growth in the City of London, make lots of profit, paying tax, and you call that growth. But growth in areas we want, growth in rail, for instance, growth in community is, you know, we want things for the community.
But
we
how
want better roads, better pavements.
Wages? We never
growth
hear about
wages
that.
Would be a good, oh, well, that's inflationary, you see. They say that's inflationary because they use a notion of demand pull inflation. They say, well, there's too much money around. This is Friedman and this is ugly crew, you know. There's too much money around. Then people will automatically raise prices. Why automatically? Ask that question. Why automatically? I mean, there's more money around. They just want more of it. So that's greed. That's profit maximization, often with shareholders in meetings telling them that they want more. Everyone wants more. So then they put up prices. So the wages, are, you know, boost aggregate demand too much and cause inflation. Well, actually, inflation isn't demand-driven, it's demand-enabled. I use that distinction, which some, I'm glad as a social scientist that some economists are starting to take notice of that now, because I think there's a qualitative distinction between demand-driven and demand-enabled. A lot of demand there enables people to put up prices, but it doesn't force them to put up prices. It's the prices that cause the inflation. So we get everything the wrong way around, but because of neoclassical economists look at the world through the wrong end of the telescope. They look at the world from the financial economy to the real economy instead of looking from the real economy to what the financial economy can do to help it.
Well, look, you mentioning housing, particularly rent, etc.
Yeah.
This is a massive slice, an increasing slice of people's
massive,
wages.
Yeah.
It's also very unrealistic if you're looking at how much it actually costs physically to build a house, the materials
Yeah.
and the man hours go into it, to
Yeah.
actually buy one or to rent one. Well, you're talking about astronomical figures in comparison to,
Sure.
you know, a home lasting for 100 years or 150 years or whatever. And so there are questions about this whole thing of demand for housing being increased. The government now saying, well, we're going to get private house builders to build all over the countryside, relax planning laws. But it seems to me that maybe it's mass migration, which is one of the things that's been driving this up. So the economy itself hasn't really been doing very much at all in terms of growth. The only growth has been coming from the housing market going up, new houses being built because of mass migration. So is this mass migration, do you think, good for the economy? That's the question.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, what we're talking about is a growth in what economists, well, the better economists anyway, proper economists, call financialization. We have in Britain and in the USA too, financialized economy. So we see growth in loans and growth in all of these financial instruments, derivatives, and all the rest. We see that it is as growth. Well, it isn't. It's simply growth in the transactions that are being made between lenders and borrowers. And there's no growth in the real economy. I mean, we're not growing useful services and like health and education, and we're not paving roads and doing all the stuff people want. So we've got this huge asset bubble that was blown up 40-odd years ago. Oh, no, guess who got in 40-odd years ago, you know, and released capital controls and deregulated everything and deregulated the lending, the banks, and told everyone that they should buy their own council houses. Well, you probably old enough like me to remember all that happening, Tony. And everyone thought it was going to be great. They were going to be property owners, like John Locke said, you know, life and liberty and property and all the rest of it. And they're going to be free property owners. And they ended up getting in loads of debt. But, of course, they paid that off. Inflation started paying that a lot of that debt off of them, making their debt cheaper. So they took out consolidation loans. Do you remember these things in the 1980s and 1990s? Oh, borrow some more money on your house, on your mortgage, and get yourself into further debt and go on holiday and just enjoy yourself, live for the day. And it was all this debt was mounting up. And the financial economy loved this because, well, they trade debts as assets on the derivatives market. So they actually sell your debts to each other. And then they have these things called credit default swaps and other instruments, which actually insure them against losses. And then they short sell and long sell. And then they have all of these weird and wonderful instruments and methods of transaction, and they make loads of money out of it by trading in your debt. So the more debt you're in, the more they can trade. The whole thing is utterly disastrous. It crashed in 2008 due to irresponsible lending, and it will crash again. We don't know
Hang on,
when.
because it didn't quite crash, did it? It was almost teetering on the brink, and the government bailed them out.
Well, this is the libertarians and neoliberals argue the government should stand back and get out of the way. But every time they make a mess of it, it has to step in and give them this thing called QE. It was a term invented by the economist. I think it was Richard Werner from Southampton who invented that term. It's basically called quantitative easing, where banks buy back loads of loads of bonds and they shove money into the bank's reserve accounts. It's non-inflationary because it simply disappears in the banks of reserve accounts. So money has to be circulating and being spent to enable demand, enable prices to rise. Let's use that word enable, not drive. So they just disappears in the bank's accounts. It's actually about giving the banks their liquidity back. So they can start lending again, but they didn't because it was risky and demand was down and they didn't want to lend too much money out. So we had this thing called austerity. Let's all cut our belts. The banks aren't lending. Let's minimize welfare. Let's just get people doing awful jobs in the service economy, the 0-hour contracts, and just let people get by in anywhere. We had this huge expansion. I mean, I worked in criminology departments for a long time, looking at sort of economic crime, financial crime, violence, all of these sort of crimes. And this is how I came to economics through looking at that. And the huge criminal shadow economies all over the country. They're not necessarily violent. They're not necessarily doing it alarm, or is intimidation, violence part of it? But people just did, basically, used to call it the black market before political correctness set in. We call it the shadow economy now. And it doesn't count GDP. It's not counted in GDP, but it's part of the wealth creation of the country. People are making transactions, getting their hands on stuff and selling it all the time. We don't know how big that shadow economy is. There's no proper research into it. And, it obviously stands to reason, doesn't it? Because the shadow economy is in the shadows. You can't see what's going on. You need some very intrepid ethnographers and researchers to expose it. So this country's in quite a big mess, but we don't really know how big a mess it's in
Well,
because we're
there's
not,
another
as you
problem
say.
too, Steve, and that is we're seeing a lot of cartels and monopolies operating, which are
That's
crowding
right.
out. I mean, I'm just thinking about something as simple as the Baker's, Greggs, or Wetherspoons and the pub chains. So some of these, well, they're starting to monopolize markets. It's big companies coming into many, many towns around the country and crowding out the small family businesses that used to happen. So,
Absolutely.
and also,
Absolutely.
of course, you've got an overlap here with some supermarkets owning organizations. So, this is, say, for example, a private equity firm that owns a chain of supermarkets and another chain will merge the two, say, like we see Argos shops popping up in Sainsbury's stores. So, really, the small local business can't compete with these
No,
big
no.
multinationals because they've also. Many of their profits are being made abroad, and they've got a whole bunch of smart accountants making sure they're paying little or no tax.
That's right. And we add to that disposability and inbuilt obsolescence, where things just be thrown away. And do you remember when people used to come around, fix your washing machine, fix your TV, these guys in these, coats used to come around and with tools and fix things. That's all gone. So, there's obsolescence is built into most products. We've got monopolies in almost everything. Music business, for instance, globally, is two big companies own almost all the subsidiary record labels and the platforms where you now buy music and you pay whatever it is per month on Spotify or 12 or 14 quid or whatever it is, you get any tune in the world. How are the artists getting their royalties? They're getting about 0.003 of a pound for plays, and they're getting nothing.
Well,
You
let
get
me
30,
just
30
weigh in here on the radio stations because we've now got thousands of franchises, or hundreds anyway, of franchises around the country owned by the same group. Usually it's Global or one of these radio stations based in London, and they amalgamate five or six franchises that they've managed to win into one station, and then they pretend. That they've got a news service for each area, but really it's just one newsroom with a slightly different bulletin going out in each. So that's happening too. But anyway, look, all of this What I really called you about is none of this really, Steve. This is the background, is about Rachel Reeves's budget coming up, because she's looking at breaking the election pledge about no rise in income tax. She's already caused a lot of trouble for small businesses by raising the national insurance payments for employers, and there's also the inheritance tax on farmers seems to be about to kick in. She's quite into the idea of property taxes. Now, people are arguing, well, we've already paid tax, quite a lot of tax, on the money that we've used to buy this property, and now you're going to try and take it away from us. So if you could just give us an overview of what you think she might do and what she should do.
Well, the problem is that, of course, that neoclassical economists are basically institutionalized liars, and they're lying on behalf of what, we call the creditor class, those who are in charge of issuing currencies, sovereign currencies, and bank credit, issuing that out for interest-bearing loans. The other way you can issue currency is directly through the government, and of course, they charge no interest. So they want to keep it that way. And taxes don't pay for public spending. This is something agreed by most heterodox economists. Mainstream economists try to suppress this, but it's the fact that taxes don't pay
Well, wait,
for
hang on.
public
We
spending.
keep hearing that she's got to balance the books. We keep hearing that.
Well, you don't have to ban. The books are never balanced. The books have never been balanced since 1694. It's absolute nonsense. And if you look at every time the government has tried to balance the books by reducing the deficit and even moving towards a surplus, even Bill Clinton in the 1990s, you move towards recession, because what you're doing is reducing the government's net contribution to the money supply. And if the banks aren't lending, you get a lower money supply. The two types of money supply: there's the stock, which has accumulated an amount of money, and there's the flow, which is the money circulating around every day. You reduce both of those, and you reduce demand, and producers start to close down and sack people, and then that reduces aggregate demand further. Then they start putting up interest rates, and then they start talking about a recession. So this ridiculous notion that the idea of balancing the books is the books are meant to be imbalanced, because if you balance the book, there's no money around if you balance the books, because the assets and liabilities will cancel to zero. I mean, this is just,
Yeah, so you
this
want to
is
end up with
schoolboy
America,
maths.
do you, with trillions
Well,
upon trillions more debt every year?
that debt is a government debt, is actually not really debt. And that's another thing that's misunderstood. There's absolutely no need for a currency issuing government to borrow money from the reserve accounts of rich institutions like banks, insurance funds, pension funds, mega rich individuals, and all the corporations, and all the rest of it. You don't have to borrow their money. You've got a printing press, you can print it. Does printing money cause inflation? Well, only if people put prices up when there's more money around. So stop putting prices up, But they won't, because their job is profit maximization. The whole system, it's a doom loop. There's no way out of this, because the system runs on the wrong principles. And I can't emphasize enough how inevitable recessions and crashes are going to be, because that's the way we're going, So there's no need to sell bonds. I could go back to 12th century Venice, the Rialto market, when basically originally bonds were the other way around. Bankers, the first bankers who had kept people's coins in strong rooms, and then started to keep accounts and tell people they had more money in the strong rooms than they actually had, and then that led to paper money and all the rest of it centuries later. They had to pay the Doge, the governor of Venice, a bond, so in case they lost their clients' money, they had something to pay them back. But that was reversed in the Netherlands, where actually the bond is it, they give the bond to the government, and the government allegedly spends it, But you can't spend money from a reserve account. It's nonsense. And then you get all sorts of complex accounting, and in the way the fiat money system works. It was all tied to gold then, of
So
course.
can
Now,
you just explain this term fiat money?
well, fiat money is money that's a free-floating exchange, which is created by governments. It's simply printed by the central bank, and it's issued. either directly as government spending on the one hand, or indirectly through bank credit by banks licensed to issue that money for interest. So that all comes from the same source, the banks, the clearing banks. The investment banks and the shadow banking industry do this thing called leveraging, where they have special deals with the banks. They borrow money from the banks at very low interest rate, around about the LIBOR rate, you know, which is very low, below the base rate usually. And I think always, I can't think of a time when it wasn't, I might be wrong, below the base rate. And then they invest it. And so if they're borrowing it, I don't know, 1 or 1.5%, and then they're getting 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% returns, they're just making loads of money out of the state's ability to allow banks to issue their money under license. It's a setup. I mean, this has evolved now for 900 years, Tony.
Well, we need to break this somehow. So anyway, you were in Rachel Reeves's shoes and you could make some really radical changes other than using the Bank of England to just pay off the trillions in debt that the government is running up, which seems like a very sensible instant solution. Everybody's happy. What else should she be doing to adjust the way they collect taxes, the way they spend money in order to get the country back on its feet?
Do you want me an honest answer? Do you want the honest answer?
Yeah.
Nothing. She can't do anything. As soon as, of course, the central bank would buy back the bonds, and we could go, you know, direct public spending. Private investors could play catch up in the wake. We could nationalise, utilities and nationalise the banking system. Why not? We can nationalise rail. We can nationalise major manufacturing, steel, and energy. And well, energy first and foremost, I think we could do all of that. But as soon as we do that, the bond vigilantes attack. They start selling off the bonds or refusing to buy them, driving up the yields, which has a knock-on effect of driving up interest rates. And then the foreign exchange monkeys start selling off your currency on the foreign exchanges and driving down the value of your currency, causing inflation, making imports more expensive, all the businesses close, and then you're out, the government's out as fast as Liz Truss.
Well, I wonder that. But I was thinking of Liz Truss as you're saying that. Do you think that that was what happened with... She actually had some plans that might have worked that the city didn't like?
They wouldn't have worked, but the city didn't like them. What she'd planned to do was the opposite. She planned to actually lower taxes, which the city didn't like, because they know, I don't tell anyone they know, but they know that that will cause inflation, leave too much aggregate demand. She hoped that aggregate demand would attract investment from abroad. This is, you know, Larry Fink and BlackRock and Vanguard and all the rest of them. They're going to flood the country with money and set up new businesses, and they're all going to sort of go back to the 18th century, and we're going to have this organic growth of, you know, small and medium businesses, and everything's going to be put back the way that it was intended. And it's complete and absolute nonsense, because, of course, private equity is not going to invest in this country. We've got energy costs are massive, rail costs are too high, and our wages are high because we've got an overvalued currency. And we rely on cheap imports. Tony, this is a mess. I don't know if I'm going to want to go any further, because I might be depressing your listeners. That's not my intention.
I think we should at least have some thoughts about, long-term solutions. The Workers' Party does seem to be very interested in restoring people's ability to make a living, for whatever purpose. But so, come on, let's have a little bit of... some
cheer.
Some vision. Some vision.
You want
please.
Some cheer? Are you talking to the wrong person here for cheer and vision, Tony? No, I'm only kidding. Right, so what can we do? Well, it must start with public investment. We must start with, we stop selling bonds. We could maybe go with fixed interest, low yield bond and say, take them or leave them. And if they leave them, then we'll make up that gap with public investment. We'll nationalise energy. We'll go for cheap energy, maybe thorium salt reactors, Chinese developing online for 2029. I'll leave it to the engineers to tell me which are the best options. We've got wind power, which we can integrate into the system, a little bit of fossil fuel to back it up, a sensible energy system, reduce the cost of energy. And then we could start reducing the cost of business. We could bring back some judicious manufacturing. We can't make cheap electronic goods like they do in the Far East, but we can make at least some some stuff, we should bring steel, major metal manufacturing, because that's a national security issue, and start to invest in new rail networks, nationalise the rail networks, invest in public services, health, education, and also boost aggregate demand to allow small and medium enterprises to give them some customers, so that they're coming to their shops and restaurants and cafes and buy their goods and maybe start. But that must start with a huge injection of public investment. There's no other way to do it, because private investment is not interested in this country. It's interested in low wage, low cost, low tax environments in which they can maximise the returns on their investment.
Yeah, well, so are there any historical precedents for something like this?
1945.
Yeah, what happened then?
Massive public investment, nationalisation. And it was sabotaged in the 1970s. Stagflation was completely unnecessary. Banks started lending out far too much cheap bank credit in the late 1960s. OPEC put the oil prices up. We could have given the oil-using industries a 10% subsidy in controlled stagflation. Then Healy, of course, did these dodgy currency swaps in 1976, followed by an IMF loan that was only necessary because of the currency swaps. So the whole thing, I didn't want to go too far down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, but that looked like deliberate sabotage. The bankers wanted to take back control, and the moneylenders wanted to take back control of the nation and take back control of the West, of Europe and America too. So the whole New Deal was cancelled, the Great Society was cancelled, the Keynesian welfare state was cancelled, the Soviet Union was starting to stagnate, so they were less worried about people turning communism than full-blown socialism. So they attacked and they deliberately sabotaged the whole project. And here we are. We ended up, they put the neoliberals in. The neoliberals have been planning this since their meeting in 1938 in Paris, the Walter Lippmann Colloquium, and through the think tanks, you know, the Adam Smith Institute and the Institute of Economic Affairs and the von Mises Institute, all of these things. All of these people were, Hayek and the rest of them were present at that meeting, Milton Friedman present at that meeting in 1938 in Paris. And the idea was to destroy, to sever the link between democracy and the state, because they didn't trust it. They thought it was prone to populism and Nazism and Stalinism and whatever, to sever that link and to put the market in charge, because they thought the market was safer and fairer and more gentle. And it turns out to be an even more brutal master in more subtle and more subtle, widespread and long ways. So it, you know, long-standing ways. I mean, so it was a disastrous experiment. It could have been avoided, but we're now in a situation where it's going to be very, very difficult to start pulling things back. The Chinese model gives us some clues about what we can do by using state-funded policy banks, huge public investment. Their workers are now, a lot of them working in the care industry, so they're using direct state jobs, funded jobs to pay for elderly care, because they've got an aging population. Their industries are starting to automate now. They're very well advanced in AI and all the rest of it. So they know it's going to put people out of work, so they're employing them in the care industry, huge care and health industry they've got. Don't forget Mao, for all his brutality, which I won't deny, raised Chinese life expectancy by 30 years, from 35 to 65 year old in just over a decade. That's an incredible statistic.
Well, I mean, what you're describing with the renationalisation, etc., the government taking back control of the Bank of England, which Gordon Brown and various other people relinquished that control, it just sounds to me like a kind of 1960s, when I was growing up, mixed economy. It's that simple.
Yes, but that mixed economy is now seen as far left. That's most Chinese economies are mixed. Venezuela is a mixed economy. They've got one party government, so they argue that's totalitarian and we don't want that. But it sounds just sensible, social democratic, mixed economy policy.
Well, how come this work? Sensible way forward is just nowhere in sight?
Because that will take a lot of the private creditors' business away from them, and they live on compound interest and returns on investment. They get very, very rich, very, very powerful, and they invest their money in cutting-edge technology, which puts people out of work but makes them very rich. There's the Spotify example of the platform owner as a billionaire, and all the people who contribute their music, most of them anyway, are poverty-stricken, or just doing it for fun. And you have a few megastars, just to, you know, the core, but they make their money both live gigs now. They don't. The recordings don't make much money. There was merchandising and live shows are back on, you know, with all this. That's all the showmanship you see with Dua Lipa and all of these pretty girls all prancing around. That's where they make the money. So you've got that, and they'll invest in that, they'll invest. But that's, as you say, it's monopolization. Fewer and fewer people are becoming, you know, rich, and the rest of us are left basically with crumbs from the table.
Yeah,
and that's the way it's
big
going.
Big vested interests in all of this, keeping us ignorant, which annoys me. Well, look, anyway, Steve, yeah. I know there are one or two, if you could just within the next minute or so wrap up. One or two really good economists we should know about and how listeners can find and follow you.
Yeah, well, I'm on X. I've gone private for the moment because I said some stuff about Venezuela. I was attacked by hundreds of bots, you know, these bot accounts, which with the strange anime cartoon avatars. Now AI is producing what are called conversant bots or conversational bots, where when they say something stupid, you tell them to go forth and multiply, but they come back at you and they keep answering you. It's a bit like talking to Grok or DeepSeek or something like that. So now you're swamped with these bots. And if you say anything controversial, you're just basically buried. And some of them are very abusive and nasty ad hominem, you know. You add that to the MAGA numpties and the supporters of Machado and all the rest of it, and they pile in as well. So it's very, very difficult.
Look, we've got very little time, so please.
Okay, sorry, you'll be able to find me back on X soon when I open my account again. But look at the work of Steve Keen. Michael Hudson, particularly. Some of the modern monetary theory guys are worth a read. Bill Mitchell, some of them less so. But look at any heterodox economist who is going against the grain of orthodox neoclassical economics. Steve Keen, Michael Hudson are the best for me.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks very much.